Good evening and welcome to the BVB London Fan Club podcast. This is episode 4 now, how time flies when you're having fun. This evening we've got a real flavour of BVB and Arsenal. Our guests this evening are, first of all, the president of the BVB London Fan Club, Ben McFadyen. Good evening, Ben.
Hiya, Mark. Thank you so much for that brilliant introduction. Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about the Gooners as well as my beloved Borussia Dortmund. And who else have we got on the show tonight?
And also with us, we've got Mark Brindle, who is the SLO, the Supporter Liaison Officer at Arsenal Football Club. Good evening, Mark.
Good evening to both of you. Looking forward to a good chat.
Absolutely. Fantastic. So just to touch on Mark, first of all, Mark, do you want to sort of just explain very briefly what an SLO does at Arsenal?
Yeah, basically, a supporters liaison officer is the link between the club and the fans. It's the main point of contact for fans. The main role is on match days, and I think it's UEFA actually put it in their wording of the role of the SLO, is that we can't affect the actual match result, but we can try and make sure that all fans, whoever they are, wherever they're from, actually have a good day at the game. And that's the basic point of it all. But it gets into far wider areas than that as well.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll explore some of those areas as we go through the podcast this evening. And Ben, we haven't spoken for a couple of weeks since the last podcast. I'm very jealous, actually. I get to see you running along the seaside in Portsmouth, which I wish I could do. But apart from that, what have you been doing since the last 2 weeks? That's where we spoke.
Yeah, hobbling mostly. yesterday was particularly bad. I'm down in Portsmouth, the home of Fratton Park and Pompey. No doubt our guest has been to Pompey a couple of weeks ago in the FA Cup. What was it, about 6 weeks ago?
Yeah, I was there. Yep. Hasn't changed much.
Yeah, your players didn't stop to sign any autographs, I have to say. But then it was Corona time, so yeah. What have I been doing? Writing a bit, doing a couple of articles. I did an article today on Jurgen Klopp's last season for SB Nation in the US. And apart from that, just really kind of working. That's it, really keeping myself busy. But let's get on to some BVB news. So we always do our traditional Borussia Dortmund news section.
Okay, Mark. Absolutely. Yeah. So, Ben, do you want to kick off and let us know what's been happening with BVB in the last few weeks? Obviously, it's been an interesting time, particularly when we look at sort of other areas at the moment. There's been a lot of discussion about when the leagues are going to restart, if they're going to restart at all. And particularly in France this week, Paris Saint-Germain have been awarded the championship, and I believe the European qualifying places and relegation have also gone down to a basis of average points per game gained there. And I think one or two clubs have not been particularly happy about that. And then in Germany, obviously, we were all sort of holding our breath around Angela Merkel's conversation and address on Thursday. But I understand now that that's going to be delayed to next week, perhaps, till we hear some more information in terms of what might happen in Germany. In terms of BVB specific news, Ben, what's been happening?
Yeah, great summary there. And obviously, Thomas Tuchel, the former Borussia Dortmund coach. Am I not right in thinking he was the former Arsenal coach as well?
No, not yet. No. We were thinking about it.
That's right. Arsenal were thinking about it. Yeah, that's right. I think he would have been a good coach. Anyway, he's won his second successive title with PSG. I have to say he was fairly controversial at Dortmund, but he did win the DFB Pokal Cup in 2017. So what else has been going on at Dortmund? Well, as you said, on the 6th of May, we're looking for an announcement on the on whether the league, Bundesliga, is able to start again. In typical German pragmatic way, they've been looking at ways of reducing potential impact of playing again, such as, for example, reducing the amount of people in the stadium to, I think, around 333 precisely. The interactions, the players are supposed to be taking their showers at home. or at the hotels. They are will have the press conferences will be done entirely virtually. And every little tiny detail has basically been worked out in order to ensure that the players are have absolutely minimal contact with each other and also with any potential risks. I believe that the ball boys is only down to somewhere like, I think it was about six that they're going to have. So really absolutely minimal. And essentially what happened on the back of that was that the DFL, the German Premier League equivalent, have agreed to pay the latest tranche of media money to in May to the German clubs, which means that a lot of the clubs which are extremely financially concerned about having no ticket revenue and so on will at least get the media money. For example, in the case of our neighbours, the word that should never be spoken, Schalke 04, I've said it now. they were in particularly tight financial situation. So they were very much in need of that payment of media. I think basically no club can manage without media now. Apart from that, Mark, there have been there was a small, a minor signing, an under 19 player, Julian Pauli, who the Daily Mail reported as being on the potential lookout on the radar of Manchester United. But as we know, that doesn't mean very much. And Dortmund have also been looking at, they're still negotiating with Meunier, the left back at PSG, who looks like he won't be getting a new contract at the Stade de France. And I think would make an exceptionally good left back for Dortmund. In the position of Manuel Akanji, who basically has been pretty ropey since coming from Basel 2 years ago. I don't really like to do the old transfer speculation too much because, I mean, so many names are thrown around. But obviously, Mario Götze is still kind of, that story is still bubbling. He's been linked with Lazio and Roma and... Karl-Heinz Riedler, the Dortmund legend, was saying this week that he thought, having played himself at Lazio, he thought that Serie A would be a particularly good match for Mario Götze. And then lastly, I think we couldn't get away without mentioning one young Arsenal player that's been linked to Dortmund. But perhaps, Mark, you'd like to do that one.
I couldn't tell you who you're talking about, but...
I think certainly from my perspective and Mark's perspective, I think it would be a really sad loss for Arsenal. But who Ben's obviously referring to is Saka at left back, who's been really sensational since he's come to the fore. And I think this past season, he's or the season to date, actually, he's assisted more than any other player in the side. Yeah. And he's been absolutely a wonderful player, somebody who's been playing at left back, which is probably out of position for him as well. He's more of a left-sided midfield player and likes to go forward. And perhaps if Kieran Tierney gets fit at some point, then Tierney will slot in at left back and Saka play in front of him, which will be quite an exciting left-hand side, I think. But I'm not surprised that... you know, BVB, if he was going to move at any point, would be a name that would be mentioned because obviously BVB have had huge success with a lot of young players and players coming, you know, across from England and slotting into the team and you know, really taking themselves forward. So, he's a super player. And I think I'd be very surprised if Arsenal would let him go, actually. Would you sort of agree with that, Mark?
Yeah, definitely. I think the feeling is that the contract negotiations are going well. Obviously, the current situation hasn't helped. I think it was on the verge of being completed just before we all got sort of sent home, really. And, you know, so I think his long-term future is definitely playing a bit further up the pitch as well. And I think Mikel sees him as an integral part of the... future of the squad. So, you know, he's got guaranteed first team football more or less now. obviously wages will come into it as well, which I think you know, is going to be what he's holding out for and what his agent is holding out for. Obviously, every time he has another good performance and another assist, I think the demands go up again. So
sure, yeah, absolutely, no doubt. And I suppose the other piece of news, and I think it's some good news actually, is a player that used to play for both BVB and Arsenal who had contracted the coronavirus, which was Jens Lehmann. Yeah. Fortunately, Jens seems to be on the road to recovery now, so I think he's okay, from what I understand. So that is good news.
Yeah,
good news. And indeed, that's a player who played for Arsenal and the dreaded Schalke as well. And
he started out there, didn't he?
Pretty famous. He actually scored a goal against Dortmund. He came running out of his box and scored a goal. I can't remember quite what season it is, but perhaps by the end of the season, by the end of the show, I'll be able to remember the match. But it was pretty extraordinary. I think it was a header, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But the only other bit of news I completely forgot, and by the way, Manuel Akanji is, of course, a right back and not a left back, is Ansu Fati from, have I said that right, from Barcelona?
Dortmund, yes.
Looking at spending a bit of cash on him if he potentially, but again, that's just built in Germany, the equivalent of the sun. So I'll shut up now and let's get into talking about Arsenal, a legendary English club, a club I've always enjoyed watching at the Emirates and at Highbury. I remember, what was it about? Tell me now. I went to watch them against the old Wimbledon, the crazy gang at Highbury in the FA Cup. Mm-hmm. I think it must have been about 1998. Is that possible?
Possibly.
Yeah. Could have been. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I also went to watch them against FC Cologne as well. Dortmund fans have a very strong relationship with FC Cologne. And that was quite extraordinary when they apparently stormed the clock end. But I didn't see anything like it, but it was a phenomenal. I remember being in the what's the other end called? Not the clock end,
the North Bank,
and we bought our tickets off some Arsenal fans. A friend of mine's a season ticket holder, and Cologne went 1-0 up. And being with the German crowd, obviously, we just slightly punched our fist, just a little bit of celebration. And immediately everyone came down on us, was like, what are they doing in here? What are they doing in here? Just like, all right. Anyway, I managed to persuade them that I was British and he went on to win the game. So it was pretty cool. Do you have
any always forgiven
that game? Mark Brindle?
What, is this the Cologne game at the Emirates you're talking about?
Yeah.
Funny enough, I actually didn't attend that game, which is, I'd been quite ill just before that, and I was sort of making a sort of comeback, and so I wasn't quite up to match duties at the time, and my wife had booked tickets to go and see a comedian at Stratford, and Mickey Flanagan, massive, great tour, and we were there, and I was getting text all the time, telling me that the game had been delayed by 30 minutes, 40 minutes, and Cologne had stormed the stadium, basically. Yeah. And so I was better off out of it because I don't think many people got home, staff-wise, until the really early hours of the morning after that game. It led to a lot of repercussions within the club and for future visits, like the Frankfurt visit this season. It was a strange time.
Absolutely. I was at the game and I remember I was in the pub with some friends having a few beers before the match, and then we sort of saw the notice, well, it's been delayed for half an hour, and then it got delayed for an extra 15 minutes. So it just meant that we had to consume a couple more beers before we went in. But once we got into the ground, the atmosphere was sensational. I mean, the Cologne fans made so much noise, and it was a bit of a party for them because I believe, and I'm sure Ben will know better than me, I believe it was their first game back in Europe for about 25 years. And so that's why they had so many fans there. Yeah.
Spot on, yeah. 25,000 fans marched down the Oxford Street. They're assuming that was the main sort of shopping street in London. I suppose it is.
Yeah.
We had played Spurs the night before at Wembley. I think we I think we lost the game. Was it the game we lost 3-0?
I think so.
And the night before that, I'd organised a reception party, a pre-match party, which we always do at the London Fan Club, which I run. And we had 500 people come to that over a from about 4 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 4 in the morning. And we also had Jörg Heinrich, the former Dortmund defender, came down and had a party with us there. Absolutely fantastic. Do you remember Jörg Heinrich, German defender?
Played yeah, I remember the name. Yeah.
Funnily enough, Mark Brindle, you'll like this. I actually asked him which team you Jörg Heinrich is wanted to play for, would like to have played for in the Premiership. And he actually said he'd had the contract negotiations with Arsene Wenger to join Arsenal.
Really?
1997.
Yeah. Blimey.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. There's, you know, a lot of players that have nearly joined us over the years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it was a fantastic couple of days. The next day, as I said, after 4 o'clock, and then we met up with the FC Cologne fans and had a really great time in London, walking around and so on. And then went on the march and went to the match. And yeah, I mean, it was very exciting for the Cologne fans, obviously. I've still got the sticker somewhere, actually.
Right. Excellent. So I guess moving on to Arsenal's season to date, Mark Brindle, it's been an interesting season, to say the least. Obviously, we've had a change of manager at Arsenal. There's certainly been, I mean, in terms of the crowd that I've noticed, has been a real difference in feeling. It feels like sort of two halves in terms of feeling, i.e. the sort of the end of the Unai Emery era and then the beginning of Mikel Arteta's era. What are your thoughts around it, and how do you think it's gone so far?
Well, I think it goes back even further as well. I think it goes back to the last month, 6 weeks of the previous season, you know, when we were in a very strong position to qualify for the Champions League. And it was one particular game, I'm sure you remember it, against Crystal Palace. And he picked a very strange team, a very weak team. And we didn't get the result we wanted in that one. And it sort of went downhill from there. And then the Europa Cup, obviously, long trip out to Azerbaijan. And the defeat there, and it was a humbling defeat in the end. Really, then sort of we come back at the start of the next season and you thought, well, you know, Unai, he's got his team, he's got his players that he wants now. We need to kick on. But there was definitely a sense of, and people were still giving him the benefit of the doubt, I felt. But we just seemed to stagnate again. And, you know, in my dealings with Mr. Emery were very minimal, but he always seemed a very fair man, a very honest man, but I just don't think he really got the message over to the players. And then he definitely lost the changing room. There was all this stuff with Ozil, you know, and then it just sort of seemed to peter out almost. And I think the board made the right decision. And I also think they got the right man this time. The only person that I might have put in front of him would have been Patrick Vieira, but that's just personal. But, you know, having the dealings we've had so far with Mikel have been fantastic. And you sense that he's got a real drive in him and he knows what he wants. And, you know, things have changed. And you can definitely sense a bit of momentum going forward. Again, obviously, the breaks come at a poor time because we were on a roll. But, you know, I think it's only looking positive at the minute.
He strikes me as a real thorough, detailed sort of guy and sort of leaving no stone unturned, really.
Yeah, definitely. I think he's, you know, a modern coach. It's minute detail. And as I say, he's got a plan. And I don't think he will suffer people not pulling their weight. He wants to know what everyone's doing and what they can contribute towards the club. He knows the history of the club. You know, he's a proper Arsenal man.
And obviously Ben was describing before how BVB have been coping during the coronavirus and what's been happening at Arsenal. You were saying that obviously about 6-7 weeks ago now you're all effectively ordered home. So how are things gone from there in terms of the club?
Well, so yeah, we were all ordered home. So working from home, we're in regular contact. We have a weekly meeting with the chief executive that gives us an update, but our departments all meet. We meet virtually daily. So just really sort of, instead of working on a match-to-match basis, we're now working on some long-term planning and, going from there, really.
Okay. Over to you now, Ben, really. I think to touch on perhaps some of the history between BVB and Arsenal. They've obviously met a number of times in the Champions League group stages, and the games have certainly been very close as well for the most part. And also the clubs have shared quite a few players and some really top players between them. So what are your recollections, Ben, of some of the matches, first of all, that have taken place between the two sides?
Yeah, thank you so much, Mark Brindle, for sharing insights into the current season. I also likewise wasn't too sure whether Arteta would be the right coach, but it seems to be working out well. I guess kind of a starting point, I've been watching some of the old videos of Arsenal-Dortmund games. Obviously for us, for Borussia Dortmund, I've been a Dortmund fan because my stepdad came from there. We grew up there and I've enjoyed Dortmund since I was about 10 years old. And I've been watching them since the 1980s. I'm giving my age away a bit there. But I particularly fondly remember the 2-1 win at the Emirates in the Champions League. Mm-hmm. Not especially because of the game, although it was brilliant to win, because winning at a ground like that is always amazing. But do you know Drayton Park, the station?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There's a warehouse there with some old factory machinery. I don't know what they do there. There's an old Greek guy that owns it. Anyway, at the time I was able to hire the hall, the warehouse, and he literally let me come in, put a bathtub in front of the on the forecourt, fill it with ice, and fill it with tins of beer from Aldi, German beer. And a little barbecue and doing some sausages and buns and stuff. And we literally just threw up a sheet on the wall, covered the machines, and we had 200 ticketless BVB fans, and Puma came down and raffled some strips. So it was all very good until the police turned
fantastic.
Up.
Fantastic. Yeah.
2-1 goal.
Oh, there must have been a great atmosphere in there.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. Actually, the funny part was when the German police came, these absolutely huge German coppers came. They must have been about 6'4" or 6'5" or something. Germans can be pretty tall. And they just came in and they said, in quite a officious sort of German, "What are you doing here?" And then I kind of popped over and then they kind of completely ignored me. And then they said, I'm organizing a viewing of the match. And for those who don't have tickets. And then they just patted me on the back and said, "Good job. Just make sure they get on the coaches on the after the match." So it was a pretty good experience. And we had half a dozen people, including the general manager of Puma in the UK, that came down. So from Puma, that is. And so, yeah, it was good experience. Really good. I don't know if you could do that now would you still get away with something like that, Mark Brindle?
Oh, I think you probably would. There's lots of local little businesses that will, take your money if you want to give them some money for hiring places, and the police, we're pretty easy going about European sides coming over. I think the one thing Arsenal fans and I think London football fans in general can't get their heads around is how passionate everyone is about the Europa Cup. Know, it's just it's mind-boggling. I mean, going back to the Frankfurt game earlier in the season, and you know, they were going mad for it, and we was just like, oh, it's just another Europa Cup game. So I think you'd probably get people biting your hand off if you wanted to hire somewhere out.
Yeah, the first place we tried was the Drayton Arms pub, but the landlord there, who you probably know.
Yeah.
I'll say nothing more about that.
Yeah. Well, but that's the official away pub. So, you know, he's used to, he's earning his money. That's his big earner. And you wouldn't want to drink in there, really, unless it was a match day, I've got to say.
Yeah. So in essence, Europa League, Frankfurt, I mean, it was a very huge season. If I'm not mistaken, that Frankfurt got to the final of the Europa, which they lost to Chelsea. And funnily enough, I don't know how...
They got semi, didn't they?
Was it the semi?
Yeah. Because we were watching it. It was a penalty shootout, and we just finished our match against Valencia. And we managed to find a bar... and there was just hundreds and hundreds of Arsenal fans in there, trying to get to see this little screen in this bar in Valencia, all cheering on Frankfurt because we didn't want to play Chelsea. But yeah, didn't quite work out right.
Spot on. That's right. Of course, the final was Arsenal Chelsea in Baku.
Yeah.
Which now seems like the most absurd place to play a final ever, given the amount of air miles.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
But yeah, the Frankfurt run last season was impressive. And one of the things about German football, which I don't know, I'd love to get your views on German football a bit later on in the show, Mark Rindle. But I know Shep is in. I know he's a big Borussia Dortmund admirer and also a Bundesliga fan. But a lot of the BVB fans that I know in London and German fans generally actually went to that Chelsea semi-final because there's something about, like, you know, the German kind of attitude of, well, if it's a German team, as long as it's not Schalke, they will basically, to some degree, kind of support them and want to see them win. And I like that. I think that's quite congenial, quite a nice attitude. But I don't think that would apply in England so much, would it?
No, not at all. To be honest, I virtually always support the opposition team, especially when it's Spurs. Obviously, that's not a that would be every team that plays Spurs. But yeah, generally, you know, there's no love for Liverpool or Manchester United. So it's definitely a lot more divided.
Yeah,
we wouldn't see it as a national thing. But plus the fact, you know, as well, with the days of the Premier League now, most of the teams are not, they're so international anyway. So you haven't got that thing of like 11 Liverpudlians playing for Liverpool and 11 Englishmen playing for Liverpool or 11 Englishmen playing for Arsenal. So you know, we won't
use the word Scousers. That would be very impolite. The Liverpool were on the Matt from the Liverpool Echo was on the show. We're doing a Liverpool special last week. And I'll be on their podcast, the Blood Red podcast, the week after, talking BVB, Borussia and Liverpool friendship. Talking about the European matches, a game I was particularly intrigued by, and I don't know whether either of you watched that, was the match at Highbury in 2002-2003, which was an Arsenal 2-0 win.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about your recollections of that match, because I was absolutely intrigued. I mean, I used to love Highbury as a ground. I think it was one of the classic English grounds. What are your recollections, either of you, about the Highbury game at that point?
Well, to be honest with you, I can't remember a lot about it, but I do remember that Dennis Bergkamp scored, and I think Freddie Ljungberg scored as well. As far as I remember it, it was fairly straightforward victory that night. It wasn't quite as close as some of the matches to come.
Yeah. I think at that time as well, you know, Arsenal won the double in 2002, and they had a very strong side from that period, from particularly from 2002 through to 2004. And I think I'd sort of spoken to you about it before, Ben. I think at the time BVB themselves probably weren't quite as strong, but the Arsenal side then was very, very strong. So I think they won the game comfortably. However, when they played the return game in Dortmund, BVB won the game 2-1. So, you know, it's as I say, it's the rivalry in terms of matches between the two. There's been no dominant side. Neither side has sort of run away, you know, consistently winning games. It's been very to and fro.
And even the old home field advantage doesn't seem to be too is it? So
no, that's it, yeah.
It's interesting you say that. Yeah, 2001, 2002, Dortmund were champions of Germany, and Arsenal were champions of England. Yeah. And the ties were pretty balanced. Dortmund won in Dortmund. Arsenal won, in my opinion, more convincingly at Highbury. But in goal for Dortmund was one Jens Lehmann, and in goal for the Gunners was one Tommy Rosicky, and you must have memories of little Mozart, Mark Brindle.
Yeah, I think out of all the players that have played for both clubs, and you know, there's been some good ones, as you say, Jens, people like that. Thomas is my favourite, and it's just a shame that his career at Arsenal was largely spoilt by injury. There was a period when he was absolutely dominating matches. Can't remember the year, but it up until Christmas, and you watched the highlights of those matches up until then, and you know, he was involved in everything. And then he got injured and we faded away, which is a bit of the story of like the last 10 years of Wenger. You know, we'd get so far and then fade away, but that season we really, really missed him. And I think he was out for virtually the whole of the next season as well. So it absolutely shame. And when I started work at Arsenal, it was his last season. And I had to work with him on a couple of things. And I tell you what, such a gentleman, a really, really one of the good guys. You know, a pleasure to actually work and talk with as well. So great guy.
That's really good to hear. Very much loved at Dortmund. Did you have memories of those players, Mark Brindle?
Yeah. So
Mark Brindle, Mr. Shepherd, indeed.
Yes. Ah, there you go. Yeah. Exactly. No, I'm a bit like Mark Brindle. I'm a big fan of Thomas Rosicky. To me, it was he was the classic guy that Arsene Wenger was looking for at the time. I mean, when Arsene Wenger first came to Arsenal, he had the imposing figure of Patrick Vieira in the midfield and Emmanuel Petit playing next to him. So they had a very strong midfield. But as time went on and those guys moved on, I think Arsene was very much influenced, I believe, by the success of the Spanish national team and the success of Barcelona, with a lot of little guys in midfield, but fantastic ball players. And to me, Thomas Rosicky falls into that category. I mean, fabulous feet, great shot. Movement was tremendous, and I think he just fitted the bill perfectly for Arsenal at the time and what Arsene was trying to do. And as Mark Brindle quite rightly said before, unfortunately, he just was plagued with injury issues right the way through his Arsenal career. And had that not been the case, I think he would have been an absolute superstar for Arsenal. For us in England, we'd seen obviously some of his performances at BVB and how good he was there. But also for the Czech national side, I remember he really sort of hit the headlines when he got a couple of goals in a big, I think it was a big World Cup match, actually, for the Czech Republic. And everyone was like, wow, this guy's sensational. And before you know it, Arsenal had signed him. So the excitement level was tremendous. And obviously he was a big influential factor in the success of BVB whilst he was there as well.
Absolutely. A very popular player in Dortmund, very much loved and well remembered, along with his Czech colleague, Jan Koller, who was, I can't remember how tall he was, but he must have been almost 2 meters tall.
Yeah.
There's an expression in Dortmund, in Germany, called Brechstange. Do you want to try saying that, anyone?
Brechstange.
Yeah, Brechstange means like an iron bar. You know those iron bars that you would open a crate with? I can't remember what that's called, but that's basically what it means.
Crowbar.
Yeah. Crowbar. Yeah, he was called the crowbar. He was bald cocoon, underneath the cap, I'm also more or less bald as a coon. In fact, Shep, you're not. You've got a nice head of hair.
I'm not going to gloat now. It's all right.
Let me go on. It's all the stress of following our clubs.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, I have to say you've got one of the most enviable jobs in English football. I mean, it must be really cool working for Arsenal. And I'd love to come on to one of the players that made a big difference at Dortmund in a particular era, which is 14-15. It was Kloppo's last season, Jürgen Klopp. Actually, I just wrote an article about it today. And Dortmund went to, they played against Arsenal, and Henrik Mkhitaryan scored the first goal. And it was not a good season for Dortmund, but that was a very good win against the Gunners, 16th of September 2014. Have you actually been out to Dortmund to watch a game?
I've been to a couple of games, the 13-14 game and the 14-15 game. So I've been there a couple of times. Really enjoyed it. Great stadium. You know, I suppose you hear it all the time. The Yellow Wall, it's just incredible. And I did find I needed oxygen by the time I'd walked up to the back of the stand where we were sitting. It was good. And little things as well, the fact that you can sit down and have a beer in a beer garden just outside the stadium, and it's a different way of doing things, and it was a pleasure, really.
That's really good to hear. It's quite a ground, isn't it? 84,000, 83,000, and usually packed to capacity. And that yellow wall behind the goal, I always love being in there. I've been going there since I was about 12 years old. And I always used to stand behind the goal, immediately behind the goal, basically behind the goalkeeper. And it's a bit like, we talked about Fratton Park earlier. Dortmund, for me, Fratton Park to me has always had a really fantastic atmosphere because it's so close, especially being enclosed with all those houses around it. But Dortmund somehow has managed to be the biggest ground in Germany and one of the biggest in Europe and still have that kind of homely, very, very close feel where basically, everyone feels right on top of the game at all times. And I think that's something that a lot of the players say, is that it really is a spectacular place to play your football. How did Henrik Mkhitaryan get on at Arsenal? Because I think he's gone out on loan to Roma. He was average when he started at Dortmund, and he grew like a fine wine. He kind of just matured and got better. And by the end, when we sold him, he was actually a pretty good player. I was just wondering what was the sort of the Arsenal experience of Henrik Mkhitaryan as a person and also as a player? Huge star in Armenia, of course. He's kind of the national legend in
legend,
football.
I think, there were occasions that he was excellent, but he was very inconsistent for us. And whether he'll get the opportunity to show what he can do, I doubt now somehow. But he, from what I heard, and this might be wrong, but he is a bit of a worrier. And he'd do 10 good things in a match, and then he'd do a bad thing, and it would lodge in his brain.
Yeah.
And then he would tail off during the match because he'd be so concerned about that. I also heard that he's a massive... The one club that he wanted to play for in England was Arsenal.
Arsenal. Man United.
Well, that's not what I was told. And I think he was putting himself under a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Did
he ever meet the man?
Sorry?
Do you ever meet the man? You would have said.
Just to say hello to, really. There's not a lot of interaction on a match day. You know, they get off the coach and it's, they're in match mode. But Henrik was one of the guys who sort of acknowledged people and said hello. So, yeah, seemed like a good guy, really.
Phenomenal. Shep, any views on Mkhitaryan before we get on to how could we not? Oba?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Marie Aubameyang. I don't think any of us are going to be kicking him out of our party. I mean, what a party legend that was. I was actually at the I was at his debut match for Arsenal. We went down against Everton and put a big BVB London fan club banner on the side, and Orba came over and said hello, which was phenomenal. I remember when he scored his goal on his debut, if I'm not mistaken, and then he ran round behind the net because he didn't really know what else to do. He hadn't really.
I can't imagine there's any Arsenal supporter out there that doesn't love Aubameyang. Number one, how much fun is it to watch a footballer play with a big smile on his face? It's wonderful. I remember the likes of Ronaldinho when he was at Barcelona. That's one of the big things that always struck me about him. Supremely talented footballer, but always played with a big smile on his face. And Aubameyang does the same thing there. Obviously, he's got electric pace. He seems to have that knack of just appearing at the right time in the right place to get on the end of great crosses and balls into the box. So he scores lots of goals, and his goal record for Arsenal has been excellent, just as it has been for BVB previously. I think it's a little worrying at the moment as a follower of Arsenal that obviously there's all this talk at the moment that he may not be there in the next season because he'd be a massive loss. And a huge game for wherever he went. So I certainly hope that doesn't happen because he's been purely from the fact of just watching him play football. He's a lovely footballer to watch.
Yeah, I met him at the Dortmund have a Christmas party every year for the fan clubs, and we've got 960 fan clubs, so it does get quite cozy. But they give one of the lounges, and they have free beer and food and so on. And two people from every fan club can go, and then all the players come down, and then they sit on a long table and sign the autographs, and then the players go behind the bar after the food and has been served, and they pull the pints. So if you're lucky, you get to chat with the players. And one of the players I chatted with was Aubameyang. And I brought with me, we just signed Jadon Sancho at the time, whenever that was, 2000, I'm not even going to try and guess, it was 2018. And I got myself one of the England under 17 World Cup Jadon Sancho shirts, number 11. And I went over, and Sancho was standing next to Oba, and I gave Sancho the shirt. And Oba kind of grinned and looked at this young sort of 17-year-old Jadon Sancho, who was grinning from ear to ear, feeling really proud about his World Cup 2017, under-17 World Cup shirt. And it was just quite funny looking at the future of Borussia Dortmund and basically the best star player at the time. Not realizing that Jadon Sancho then would turn into probably one of the biggest football players in the world. Mm. I think, basically a player that any club, including Arsenal, will probably like to have in their ranks.
Mm, for sure.
Well, and a player that we could have had in our ranks as well. But
is that right?
Yeah. So he was desperate to get out of Man City. He's very, very, very close friends with Reece Nelson. And the deal was on the table. They basically asked Arsenal to come and get him and take him away from City. And the money men didn't feel it was worth the minimal outlay that it would have taken. It would have been far less than was paid in the end. It passed us by. Another player that passed us by. So yeah.
Do you guys think that the reputation? I was reading a book about Arsenal that Arsene Wenger basically had a reputation after they built the Emirates ground of being particularly penny pinching, and that was one of the reasons that he was hated. But to be frank with you, you've seen some phenomenal players, not just from Dortmund like Mkhitaryan, Rosicky, and Aubameyang, but also my favourite Arsenal player at the moment is Papa Socrates, who we call Papa in Dortmund. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. Do you think Wenger deserved the reputation for penny pinching Brindle? Mark, is it true?
I don't think necessarily so. The fact of the matter is Arsenal have always been run on an even keel. So, you know, they will not go into debt unnecessarily. That's not their way. And part of the stadium move was that we would run the ship properly. We wouldn't go into massive debt. And, you know, he did, I think he was a very stubborn man. And, you know, he wanted to do it his way. And that might have meant that when agents came and started renegotiating deals that he felt had already been done, yeah, maybe he wasn't going to play ball with them, which might have cost us. But as you say, we've had plenty of good players anyway. So,
and Shep, your view of Papa is that he hasn't really had a chance to shine, you were saying to me earlier on in the week on the phone. He was incredibly consistent when he came from Werder Bremen to Dortmund and absolutely respected and admired throughout. A man of not very many words, I have to say.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think he's played obviously a number of games for Arsenal, but I think Arsenal have been in that sort of phase of trying to find out what their best pairing is at the back, in the centre. And obviously, he's been a part of that. On top of that, we need to remember that there's also been a managerial change. So, you know, there's been a lot of upheaval in a short space of time. And it's not an easy environment. But and as Mark Brendel was saying before, it's a shame now because Arsenal sort of had just been settling into quite a nice rhythm, I think, under Arteta. And clearly they understand everybody. I think everybody understands the jobs that they need to do now. One of the biggest improvements I think we've seen has been defensively. Yeah. And obviously Sokratis is a part of that. And I think he would have enjoyed playing in a defence where everybody really knows their roles and they're working as a unit. And I think probably beforehand, he probably felt that, it wasn't quite as thorough, perhaps the work that was being done on the defence and everybody was a little bit uncertain. But I think under Arteta, make no mistake, they know they have to do a job. They know what it is. Yeah. And they've got to go out there and do it. And I think I'm sure he would do a lot better in that environment.
Well, Brindle, have you met Papa or Aubameyang on any occasion?
Yeah, I've met them both. Papa, as you say, Papa is a man of few words. But he's a very decent guy, very straight down the line. Doesn't suffer fools, I think, is probably what I put him. And,
on the pitch and off the pitch.
Yeah, exactly. And what I love about him on the pitch is that he always gives 100%. There was a bit of a worry about him and his pace in the Premier League. He's when he gets up and scores as well, his celebrations are fantastic. It's very good. And Alba, yeah, I have met him. I've had a word with him about his dress sense. But apart from that, I can't fault the man. Great goal scorer. Again, another one that really gives 100% every game. He's been asked to play wide, play up front, play with different partners. But he always puts it in and drives a lovely car as well. But yeah.
What's driving nowadays?
He's driving a gold Lamborghini.
Outrageous. In Dortmund, it was an Audi. It was a, as far as I remember, it was an Audi. It was sort of platinum coloured and it was really pretty outrageous. It's interesting to hear. I mean, I've been hearing rumours about him potentially leaving the club and I don't know whether you feel he's had his time. I mean, basically, he certainly made an impact. Dortmund, he scored more than 100 goals and he came on I can't remember what the transfer budget, I think it was about 10, 15 million, something like that, from Saint-Etienne in France. And he left for 58 million, if I'm not mistaken, to Arsenal.
Yeah, that was a record signing for us at the time.
Yeah. And I think, well, the thing is as well, the club has already stated that they're not going to let people wind their contracts down, which is we've paid for in the past. And, you know, he has got just over a year left. So this summer, you know, it's a decision time, really. He's 31, isn't he?
Yes, that's right.
So his next contract is a big contract for him personally. You know, so there's all sorts of things that come into the equation, you know, whether a transfer for him is the best financially, signing on fees, things like that. You know, I think that will come into it a lot. And, you know, if Arsenal, and I would think he's looking at Mesut's wages and probably wants parity with him. And whether Arsenal can afford to pay that, I don't know. But then again, who can, really? There's not many clubs in with what's happening at the minute that will be paying £350,000 a week.
No,
Mark, right. Mark Shepherd, you were talking. Sorry, did you want to come in on that one on the Oba, Mark?
No, I completely agree. Really, I think you know football is going to change, and you know there's probably only a couple of clubs that maybe in that position that they could potentially pay those sorts of wages for Oba, and whether those are the actual clubs that would be chasing him, I don't know. That remains to be seen.
Let's talk about the kind of similarities between the clubs. Mm. I guess as a supporters liaison officer, your role is kind of mainly fan facing. But on the same note, I mean, if it's anything like at Dortmund, they've got a team in Dortmund of 10 supporter liaison officers. And obviously they're dealing with 160 fan clubs outside of the country, and 800 fan clubs in Germany. And I don't know about you, but I think, you know, 960 fan clubs for a club, it's a lot of fan clubs, a lot of fans. I mean, they've got 15 million supporters on Facebook. I mean, those supporter liaison officers at Dortmund, Sebastian, and they all seem to be called Sebastian, by the way. I don't know why, about three of them called Sebastian. But they really do, you know, they get involved with all sorts of different aspects, you know, people sending their shirts in to get them signed, and people asking for autographs, and, you know, things like that. And also, obviously, parties, and then legends, inviting the legends over and so on. What's your before I ask you what your experience what your view is of the way Dortmund do things and how it compares to the way Arsenal do things in terms of being an academy-led club, Mark, could you just give us a couple of sentences about you know, first of all, how many fan clubs does Arsenal have? Does it compare to Dortmund? And also, what are some of the more unusual requests that you've had? And what's your day-to-day kind of work like? What's it like being the SLO at Arsenal?
Well, worldwide supporters clubs now is in the realms of about 250 to 300. So, you know, not to the numbers of Dortmund, but we... I don't know what the minimum size is of the Dortmund club, but you know, we do set minimum standards and what have you. So, so you've still got that. So I deal with all the international supporters clubs. On a day-to-day basis, the role is very, very varied, because I work within the travelling events team as well. So I get involved with all travel when we're travelling abroad, when we're travelling within the UK, and also in the events as well. So we have events at the stadium with the junior gunners, various different levels of membership. So it's quite a wide ranging role. It's quite interesting when dealing with the German SLOs in particular, about how much influence they have. They have far more influence than we would. You know, I'm only one for 60,000.
You're kidding me. There's one only at Arsenal?
Yeah. So, but there's, you know, as you say, 10. And most of the German clubs have got at least half a dozen, up to 10. And they have a lot more influence. It was interesting when we went to Frankfurt. When you go to these UEFA meetings beforehand, most clubs you're dealing with like senior officials about the plans for the game. Well, the plans were all done by the Eintracht Frankfurt's SLOs. So, you know, it did make me smile because you know, the control they had over things was incredible.
Amazing.
So and it is different.
Did you meet the Borussia Dortmund SLOs when?
Yes, I did, and I actually that thing about Sebastian rings a bell, because obviously it was a few years back now, but I was quite new in the job when we went out there, and but I did get to talk to them, and you know, the SLOs around Europe now are far more in communication, so you know, we have had the German SLO Federation or whatever it is come over and meet with us in England, all our SLOs. So
yeah,
and it seems to be a common purpose now to get some proper qualification behind the role through UEFA. UEFA is setting up a proper qualifications, and that is mainly being driven by the German and Scandinavian clubs.
Oh, interesting to hear. Yeah. Shep, you worked at Arsenal for a while in the press office. Mm. With George Graham was there at the time, the legendary former Leeds United player. Am I right in saying that? It's a bit before my time.
Yeah, well, I was there between 1991 and 1993. And it was actually my first season there was extremely successful because we won the league by only losing one match that season.
I remember it. I went to the victory parade. It was absolutely.
It's funny that 91 team is often sort of forgotten because everybody looks at the invincible side of 2004 for obvious reasons. But that 91 side was phenomenal and a brilliant defence. I think they conceded only 18 goals in the whole of the league season, which it was outstanding. George Graham was manager then. And he built up a real sort of work ethic in that side. But they had a lot of talent as well. People like Rocky Rocastle was a big player in that team. Oh. Yeah. So they had a lot of flair in that side as well. People like Anders Limpar, talking of Sweden, was in that side as well. And what a wonderful player he was to watch in that Arsenal side. So they had a lovely mix of real solidity at the back and in goal. But then sort of in the midfield and going forward, a real sort of flair as well. So it was a great balanced side, actually. They had a very strong team. And then in my final year there in 93, they managed to win two of the Cups, the League Cup and the FA Cup in the same season. The League Cup is most remembered for not really the game, but for Tony Adams, the captain, picking up Stephen Morrow and hoisting him over his shoulder in celebration, but then accidentally dropping him. And then Steve Morrow was out injured for quite some time off the back of it.
Classic. That's the guy who has the statue of Tony Adams, isn't there? At the
That's right.
Yeah.
The entrance. Yeah, he's a brilliant England player as well. I've met a few times who played out for FC Cologne, we were talking about earlier. Is a guy called Tony Woodcock. Don't know if you remember him.
Yeah, I certainly do. He's got a fine head of hair. Well, we were talking about hair earlier.
He's still got plenty of hair.
Yeah, I know. It's unbelievable. But but he's real glory days. Obviously, we're at Nottingham Forest. And he was managed by the great Brian Clough. But he came to Arsenal and he was top scorer a couple of seasons. And I remember at Villa Park, and he scored five in one match. Phenomenal, yeah.
But, that was the 6-2, wasn't it?
Yeah,
6-2 loss. And
we had a lot of good individuals in those teams those days. And talking of George Graham, really, he sorted them all out because you know, one week we'd play brilliantly, and then the next week it'd be a bit cold, and they wouldn't turn up. But George Graham wasn't having any of that. and he got it back to basics, back to the roots of the club. You know, Arsenal have always had a reputation of being a very hard-working team, and they became a bit of a showbiz team, and George sorted all that out. He had, you know, he had the benefit of a great crop of youngsters come through all at one time, as Mark was saying. So, but he was the guy who organised them, and he was the start of modern Arsenal. You know, that, you know, obviously Arsene took it on to another level, but George is a vital part of that. And I was only speaking to him just before we broke for the coronavirus. I was planning to go and meet him. So hopefully that will still be the case when I get back.
Am I right, Shep? I'm going to come to you because you wanted to talk about the academies and the similarities, which was really interesting. You were mentioning earlier in the week. But can I just ask, am I right in thinking that Arsenal, was it Arsenal, was it Man United who played a Legends game against Real Madrid and had 60,000 people? Was it the season before last? Was that right? Or was it last season? I can't remember. Was it Man United or was it Arsenal?
Yeah, we did have a game against them, yeah.
60,000 turned up for that, and you raised about 3 million for the Arsenal Foundation. Well, that was really impressive.
I think, you know, the thing was, yeah, people were... Nostalgia is a big business now, isn't it? So, you know, you've got a whole generation of Arsenal fans, of those guys were, you know, just remembered the good times, really.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, and just coming on to what you were saying, Ben, I think... you know, obviously BVB, it's certainly within England, are very much renowned for being an exciting football team to watch. I mean, rarely have I ever watched a BVB match where, you know, you've been sort of yawning. It's end-to-end stuff. It's exciting. There's lots of goals. But one of the standout things has been the opportunity that young players have had to play at BVB. And I think in England, I think people are very impressed by that, certainly. And in the Premier League, because of all of the money that's sort of flooded in since Sky came along, I think youth has had limited opportunity, generally speaking. Yeah. However, the last season or two, I think we're starting to see a bit of a sea change now. For some clubs, it's been enforced. But for others, it's actually been sort of more perhaps of a conscious decision as well to say, well, you know what, perhaps we need more of a balance between sort of signing, you know, some expensive players from abroad mixed with some players coming through from our youth side. And I think at Arsenal we've certainly seen in the last 12 to 18 months particularly a lot of really good young players coming through now, and not just playing in the League Cup matches, which used to be the thing that they did. Now they're actually playing in the Premier League, and you know, they're playing in European matches, which is a wonderful experience for them. And you know, the club have been through quite a tricky time with the changeover of managers. But the one thing you can say, even when they weren't, as a club overall, perhaps weren't performing at their best, I think the youngsters always gave 100% and always were the ones that everybody sort of walked away and said, well, OK, the result didn't go for us today. But you know what? These young players have looked really, really promising. And I think a lot of the excitement now by having Mikel Arteta there is the fact that they believe that, you know, he's the right guy to really take a lot of these young guys forward as well. And I think it's, you know, it's something very, very similar to BVB, that getting that opportunity. And I think going forward now, the youth will get an opportunity to shine at Arsenal. Whereas perhaps in the past, it might have been limited.
Yaka Saka.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's a guy called Martinelli who plays up front for Arsenal now, who for me looks absolutely sensational. I think he's really, really exciting, and I can't wait to see him play in the next couple of seasons.
Yeah, the player that impressed me at the time was Theo Walcott. Mm-hmm. I really felt that he was going to go places. I think he went to Everton in the end, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, I think Theo's a real shame, actually, because he was at Southampton and he hadn't actually played that many games at Southampton, but he'd scored some noticeable goals, which I think sort of put the alerts on everybody. And then obviously Arsenal picked him up at a very young age, and he came in with an incredible amount of raw pace. And that's obviously something that Mark Brindle had alluded to earlier on, that the Premier League really has. And so there was this great excitement around them, and everybody thought that sort of under Arsene's coaching and playing with potentially better players than at Southampton, Theo's technical ability would improve. But it, for me, and I think for a lot of other fans, it never materialised to the levels. Right. Yeah, it never really got to the sort of levels that they thought they were going to achieve, and that's a real shame, because and in the end, to me, he became more of an impact player. He was brilliant coming off the bench. You know, a game could be really tight, one each with 20 minutes to go. You could bring Theo on, and he would create opportunities and invariably sort of turn the game in Arsenal's favour. But over 90 minutes, he wasn't really quite there, I don't think. And I think that's part of the reason why he moved on. But, you know, for all that, he scored quite a lot of goals for Arsenal.
Yeah, I think he got over 100, I think, in the end.
That's right. So, yeah, exactly.
You know,
incredible. Absolutely amazing. I remember watching him in his debut match for Everton, and I, you know, hope he's doing good things there. You know, perhaps one to will appear on England's radar at some point again. Yeah. Mark Brindle, tell me, basically, what we always try to do on the show is to introduce people to who are not as familiar with Dortmund to the way it works at Dortmund. So, in essence, Dortmund's equivalent of Hale End, I think that's the name of the Walthamstow-based Arsenal Academy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is the Horn Buschei in Dortmund, in Brackel, quite near to the airport. And essentially the way it works over there is that the teams start from under, if I'm not mistaken, it starts under nines, goes all the way up to under 19s. And each of the levels or tiers, whatever levels of youth football, basically has a, I think from under 12s upwards, has a Bundesliga, so a sort of national league. Some of them being divided into regions, so west and north and south, and then others being national ones. And then the Borussia Dortmund under 19s play in the UEFA Nations League. I meant to report on them for German newspaper Ruhrnachrichten when they played Derby County, who have a phenomenal academy, by the way.
Yeah, good side.
English champions. And so that's basically how it works in Germany. And essentially, if a player comes in under 17 or under 18, whatever, they will be slotted into their age category. Basically, they'll work their way up. And the Bundesliga has just changed the rules, the DFB, so that players who are 17 and above can now play in the Bundesliga, which will apply to a very big star, a future star, Youssoufa Moukoko. I don't know if either of you have clocked him yet, but he is really something else. He's 15 years old and he's currently playing in the under 19s. So it's absolutely unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And he scored 36 goals already this season.
Phenomenal.
Not bad for a 15-year-old. So how does it actually work for the English players, basically the young players? Similar, the way it breaks down?
I think it's pretty similar. They start at a similar sort of age, and they work through the system from there. And they're at Hale End until under 18 level, and then they get their first contract, their first professional contract, and then they go up to London Colney with the full-time professionals, and they start to work from there, which is the under 23 side. And pretty similar, I think. And they play in Premier League too. Really, the younger lads, it's on not a league basis. They don't keep league tables and what have you. So like the 9s, 10s, 11s, 12s, people like that. And they'll organise matches all around the country.
Yeah, this is what I heard. They play friendlies, don't they, rather than actually league.
Yeah.
What do you think of the system in Germany, basically? Since it's very competitive, in my view, the way of actually having national leagues and national champions and so on. I actually went to the Bayern against Dortmund final of the under-19s championship, and they had a phenomenal 35,000 spectators turned up for it for a 6-5 win for Dortmund. And it really was a fantastic turnout, really, for an under-19s game. Don't you think?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, the FA Youth Cup is probably the premier tournament for youngsters in this country. And when they get to the final, the crowds tend to be quite considerable. But the earlier rounds, yeah, there's not so much interest. It tends to be weeknight games, there's not the interest. And to be fair to the most of the clubs as well, don't really push it. They'd rather let the players develop maybe on a less pressurised basis.
Something which Shep and I have been talking about is the Dortmund's second tier. So the second side, who are the under-23s, who play in Germany's fourth tier, the Regionalliga. So that's the fourth division, basically. In other countries like Spain, you see teams like Real Madrid and so on, that have their team Castellón that plays in the second division. What do you think, Mark Brindle, about that idea of having basically a second professional team? I mean, Dortmund's second team, the under-23s, they get crowds of, you know, between 1,000 and 5,000 for some of the best games. And they have a real kind of, you know, ultras following, which I think is really pretty phenomenal. What's your sort of view on that? Do you think that that's an added expense for a club, or is it a good way of testing players? How does Arsenal test the players, really, do you think, at that
level?
Well,
I think it's more they're looking towards the Champions League, the European Youth Leagues, for a test. There has been talk about second teams. The FA, a long time ago, put the block on there. Arsenal actually had a... not an official second team, but a relationship with Margate down in Kent. And they used to send a lot of their players down there for a long time. And there was talk of that more or less like a second team. I don't know whether that was particularly what the FA clamped down on, but they did stop it a long time ago that clubs weren't allowed to do that. But, you know, when you people like Raul Sanlihi, he can't understand the lack of competition for the junior players, and so yeah, I think there will be change, but English football tends to take a long time to change anything because of the you know, it has to be for in the Premier League, for instance, you know, all 20 clubs, and they all have one vote, so change is sometimes slow.
Shep, am I right in thinking that you're pretty big on the Premier League? Do you is it true that the English have brought in the a season break, a winter break for the Premiership, which is something that I know Fabio Capello and Sven Goran Eriksson in their time were pleading for, and has been very much you know, a 1 month break at Christmas has been the norm in Dortmund in Germany, sorry, in the Bundesliga. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of break hasn't happened in England yet. It's been sort of touted around for quite some time. And, you know, the weather in England, I suppose, is never brilliant at any given time for the most part. But, I think a month break potentially, you know, might be a good thing for some of the players. And I think that then we would have the end of season, obviously, stretch out possibly the last couple of months of the season in really good weather. You know, it sounds a bit strange to say it, but one of my favourite things is to be able to walk into a game in shorts and t-shirt. It's lovely, actually, to be able to do that. Don't get me wrong, there's a part of me that loves the sort of wintry type games where you're all wrapped up in, you know, numerous scarves and a big coat and hats, etc. But hey, it's actually quite nice as well. And I think some of the international players that play in the Premier League would be more than happy to be playing on sunny afternoons in sort of, you know, 20 to 25 degrees of heat as well. But,
Per Mertesacker says in his book about, you know, the shock that he had in his first season, that the lack of a break. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Per's a big family man. And he couldn't spend time with his family at Christmas. It was a massive shock to him. And he said that his body just, like, reacted so badly against the lack of a break. And, you know, with the Premier League, it's supposed to be the what they advertise it as. I'm not saying it is, but they're saying it's the best league in the world. Then surely a break would add to the quality. People will come back refreshed. It will refresh the demand as well from fans. Yeah, I think it's something that's got to come in.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was just going to say, I think as Mark had mentioned earlier, you know, it takes a little while for change to happen in England. And Christmas time particularly has always been very traditional for playing a lot of games in a short space of time. And I think it's sort of that post Christmas day and everybody wants to get out of the house and go and watch a football match. And that sort of still sticks and stays very strong in England, I think, at the moment.
I have that feeling right now after a month at home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How are you guys coping with the corona thing? Are you getting we've got to close the show, I'm afraid. I will get you give you the chance to plug your social media and so on. But how are you coping with the corona? How are you managing there, Mark Brindle and Shep? Shep, I know that you get out for your runs like me. But how are you coping, Mark? Do you keep in touch with Arsenal in these times?
Is that to Shep or to me?
No, Mr. Brindle.
All right. Yeah. So, yeah, fully, you know, my whole day revolves around Arsenal normally. So, contact with a lot of supporters. We've been doing a project where we're speaking to all our what they call at-risk supporters. So anyone over 65.
Amazing.
Disabled fans, we're calling them up, talking to them.
Amazing.
So, you know, that's been really, and that's been a lovely exercise because, you know, a lot of the old guys and girls, and they look just a chat, and they really love the fact that their club's ringing them. And, you know, with some of the stories that have been coming out about old players and old times and old memories. I mean, I go back to 71.
Really? You've been watching since 71?
Yeah, I first went in 71. So, I've got a lot of their memories, but I love the fact that they take you back even further to the great Arsenal sides of the 1950s and things like that. And, very, very interesting and, very worthwhile exercise.
Shep, I suppose we couldn't possibly let Mark Brindle get away without telling us something about his feelings for Tottenham Hotspurs, but maybe there's not very much that he needs to say about that.
Yeah, I think it's almost like it's a given, isn't it? It's I think all you need to do is if you put Tottenham equals Schalke, I think you'll probably get a fair estimate of how he feels.
Well, are you going to say anything about that?
Well, you know, I do like the fact that I'm employed by Arsenal, and I think even the people at Arsenal who know me know my feelings about Spurs, but I wouldn't like to go down on record about them.
All right. Okay. Shep,
very diplomatic.
Take it away. Let's close the show. Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. No.
You've been an amazing guest. I really can't thank you enough for coming on, and sorry for the overrun, but
it's been a pleasure, Ben.
Absolutely. And look forward to seeing you sometime at the Emirates.
Yeah, please come. Please come, and you know, we'll make you a bit special guest.
Oh, thank you. I love that. Actually, I know Josh Landy, who does your he does one of your podcasts. You know Josh?
Yeah. Well, more by name than by actual knowing him, but I have come across him before.
Yeah. Shep, over to you.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah, just to say, back up what you said as well, a really big thanks to Mark Brindle for coming on. Obviously, for me, it's been really special to be able to have a chat with you, and even beforehand, just having a chat about a few names of who've been around the club for a long time. It's been fantastic. And as always, Ben, thank you for all your insights around BVB and football in general. It's been really, really great. I think everybody will be appreciative of that.
Thank you.
So really, just to say, this is obviously episode 4 of the podcast, and you'll be able to pick that up via, I think it'll be loaded onto the, certainly loaded onto the BVB Facebook site for the London Fan Club. And Mark Brindle, first of all, how can anyone get in touch with you, Mark, if they wanted to sort of drop you a line, whether it's via sort of social media or email, etc.?
Yeah, I suppose the main contact is through email, and that's just mbrindle@arsenal.co.uk. So quite straightforward. I run the match day Twitter account, which is match day at Arsenal. But you know, the main thing is through email, and always willing to have a chat. So please feel free to get in touch. But I can't get your tickets.
Fantastic. And I can be reached as always at mark@sportslineuk.com if anybody wants to drop me a line, or you'll find me possibly at the Emirates or in a pub nearby, or at the Stamtisch at the Naughty Bar in the centre of London, probably having a beer with Ben.
Well, we couldn't get away without me plugging the Borussia Dortmund Fan Club London, which you can find Fan Club, two words. Don't ask me why I did that. On Facebook, and join the chat, and basically drop in, send us some pictures of you of you guys at Dortmund enjoying the games and so on, and tell us why you love Borussia Dortmund. And then also you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Dortmund London. And I've just checked, Jens Lehmann scored the 2-2, and it was a header in season 96-97. It was the 2-2, for Schalke. So and that was the that Dortmund won the Champions League. So
can I just tell you a very quick story about Jens? Have we got time?
Go for it.
Yeah.
Right. So we're saying about what a character Jens is and was. When we had that friendly match against Real Madrid, he was in goal and obviously retired. Not a competitive match. And Arsenal were winning quite comfortably. And they get a penalty, consolation goal. Jens made a fantastic save from the penalty, but he pushes it straight back out and one of the other players runs in and scores. So everyone back in the changing room afterwards, everyone's celebrating, all the old boys are like, what a great game. Jens comes storming in, saying, where were you? Where were you? And everyone's like, what's that again? He said, hey, save the ball. And then you were there, you stood there, watched as he put it in. And they go, but it was only a friendly Jens.
Oh, well, a sense of humour failure. We're not going to talk about Germans' sense of humour. Believe me, they have a good sense of humour. Yeah,
no, he does, definitely.
God bless you guys. Thank you so much. It was amazing talking to you again. And enjoy the rest of the weekend.
Yeah.
Thank you. And you.
Good night. Thanks, guys. All the best. All the best.